Some of you already know the answer to this. You know what it means when a preacher gets his watch out and puts it on the pulpit, don't you? Absolutely nothing. In the story of Luke 17, 11 through 19 or so, as we read earlier, we don't find anything like it in any of the other Gospels. Luke tells a story assuming that his readers understand the culture of its day. And that makes perfect sense because they all lived in the culture of the day. But mercy sakes, think how much time has passed since then. I mean, we do things so much differently now. Especially important when it comes to the story of the 10 lepers are knowing a few things that I want to review with you. Now, okay, you probably know these things already, so I'm not going to dwell on them, but I just want to make sure maybe there's somebody who hasn't heard some of this stuff. First of all, in those days, Samaritans and Jews got along about as well as Palestinian and Jews get along today. You might think about the relationship similar to the way the whites got along with the blacks back in the 50s, south of the Mason-Dixon line in the 1950s. Or you might think about going out west and the way the Westerners get along with the Navajo Indians and other Native Americans. I mean, it's not a pretty picture, no matter how you look at it. That's to understand the Samaritans. The second is to do with leprosy. Leprosy was and is a disease that affects the skin, causing a loss of feeling and eats away at the tissue to the point that sometimes body parts fall off. Yeah. Another not pretty picture. People often thought of it as a punishment from God for something that they had done. The stigma cast on a person with leprosy was to make the person an outcast, even in their own family. Wherever they walked, they were supposed to begin, as soon as they saw someone, by shouting out, "Unclean, unclean," so that the other people would know, be smart enough to move over to the other side of the road and walk by. In a sense, leprosy was something in those days like AIDS was in the United States, well, maybe is even in some places. It has a sort of stigma attached to it, as though it's associated with something bad beyond the badness of disease itself. Now, it's also true that in those days, they used the word leprosy to describe any kind of rash or permanent disease type of thing. So all leprosy wasn't leprosy. So you knew both of those. Now, the third thing, I might catch, give you something new. I don't know, but I think maybe, since you already knew all the other stuff. The new one is this, and that is the notion that this is a patron-client social system. Duh. What does that mean? Well, a patron-client is a system that manages how people of unequal social status relate to each other. A lower status person who was in need, we'll call that person a client, would have their needs met by a higher status person, called a patron. Put simply, a poor person would go to a rich person, "I need some help fixing my house. Will you loan me the money or will you give me something to help me do this?" And they will do it. So you have a client and you have a patron. In return, the client was obligated to return the favor to the patron in some way of the patron's choosing. So the patron say, yeah, I'll do that. But down the road, you got to do something for me, and I'll tell you when it is. Once it entered into this client-patron relationship, the patron was to be treated as a superior, more powerful, like head of the family type person. You might want to think about the movie The Godfather. I mean, that would give you somewhat of the image of what is expected. In addition to the return of duties, the patron's job is to sing the praises of this person. Well, maybe not sing. Not everybody can carry a tune like our choir can. But, you know, to say nice things about the person and build them up. Now, if the person gets enough praise from other clients, then their status gets built up. They get really seen as important, which this particular group of people liked. Now, there's another character involved in this. You've got the client and you've got the broker, but then you have the negotiator, the in-between person, the broker, if you will, who connects these people. The brokers, or negotiators, made the arrangements to connect the client with the patron. So a peasant in financial need or in some other service that they needed would they would go to a broker, and the broker would put them in touch with a patron who would help them take care of their problem. City officials would negotiate on behalf of a local people with the authorities in Rome. They were brokers of the imperial resources. Holy men or prophets could also be brokers on certain occasions. And once a broker established a connection between a client and a patron, the patron expected the return loyalty and public acknowledgement and honor due to them. But the broker could kind of go his way. The story that Luke related in today's reading is a patron-broker-client story. The 10 people with leprosy were the clients in need. They asked for mercy. Granted, as they began, they probably didn't think of themselves as hunting for a broker. They probably were just looking for a handout. That would be the most logical way to look at this. They just happened to get something more than they bargained for. Having asked for a handout, Jesus tells them to go show themselves to the priest. I imagine there was a bit of disappointment. Wouldn't you think? You expect to get a coin and you're said, go show yourself to the priest. What's that all about? Well, they understood maybe that if something were to have happened or changed, in order for them to get brought back into society, the priest had to verify that they had been healed. So maybe that was in the back of their mind, but for whatever reason, these 10 people with leprosy did just as Jesus told them to do. It's interesting to me that he didn't promise them that he would heal them. He didn't talk to them at all about God or forgiveness or repentance or healing or salvation or the end of time. None of those things that we hear so many people talking about today didn't seem to bother Jesus. He just simply said, go show yourself to the priest. He told them basically to act as though they were already healed. How strange. As they walked along the way to show themselves to the priest, they discovered that, by George, they were healed. One of the 9 recognized the implications of what had happened. God had healed him. God was now his patron. Jesus, then, must have been his broker. This healed man gave up on his journey to see the priest and began to acknowledge the honor due to God as patron for the healing he had received. He was a good client. He was offering praise to his patron. When he ran across Jesus again, then he went to Jesus and thanked him for his service as a broker who negotiated God's healing. Now, the big twist came when we learn that this one person who came back to praise the patron and to thank the broker was, of all people, a Samaritan, not even a good member of the church. I mean, not even a good Jew. I'm sure this must have knocked the socks off of the people who first heard this. Well, if they had socks to knock off. There is a second, a little twist in there. In a peasant society, saying thank you was a way of acknowledging that one no longer had need of a broker's service. In that culture, a person did not thank a social equal. That wasn't considered honorable in those days. Thanking a superior was very honorable, but it meant that since the inferior person could not repay the person, the mutual obligation was now at an end. They had given their thanks. It's over. That just blows me away as I learn this. So our formerly leprous friend, in essence, was saying to Jesus, I don't have anything to give you for your kindness, but thanks a lot. What's more, I don't need your service anymore. I'm glad I'm healed. Bye. It just doesn't fit what I learned at Sunday school somehow. It's a sort of a different twist. But I hope you caught some of the subtleties in this thing. Then the healed man continued on his way giving praise to God. That's when we learn that Jesus also understood his role as broker of God's mercy. He did not say, where are the other nine to give thanks to me? Not even to give thanks to God. He asked, was there none of them found to return to give praise to God except this foreigner? Praise goes to the patron. Thanks for services rendered went to the broker, the negotiator. I hope you catch that difference. It blows me away because I grew up in a time when we always thought that praising and thanking were the same thing. It was a synonym. Look that one up in your dictionary. Thanks is an expression of our gratitude for something someone does. Do you remember the words of your mother? I hope you do. When someone gave you something, what do you say? Yeah. Thank you. Well, if that's all we get, we miss the point. There is something more going on in here. So you're probably wondering, what is the point? We don't have a patron-broker culture in our world. Perhaps that's so. Still, we all know folk who have made a difference in our lives, helping us to make the connections we need to make that we can't quite seem to make on our own. I wonder who brokered or negotiated a grace gift from God to you recently. Do you have that person in mind? Back in August of 1998, our daughter Jennifer had just finished her college internship as an actuary at Lincoln Financial Group in Hartford, Connecticut. She was headed for an interview with a competing firm in Stamford, Connecticut. She was driving our beloved faithful carrier, affectionately called Sammy. Sammy was a 1986 Toyota Camry with nearly 200,000 miles on it under its timing belt. It was a nice day, and things were going along well as she traveled down the intensely crowded interstate speedway. That, as you might already have guessed, is when it happened. There was a brief sputter, as if the carburetor had swallowed something distasteful. The sputter was then accompanied by a cough and a couple of hiccups, and then nothing. Now, by nothing, I mean there was no power. She barely had enough momentum to drift the car from the fast track lane over to the shoulder. Jennifer, a fairly bright person, knew enough to open the hood to see what might be going on. After all, she had seen her dad do that many times before. Once the hood was open, she was surprised to see wires, metal boxes, and various belts of all kinds of shapes and sizes. The engine did not respond either to her verbal abuse nor her gentle coaxing that she gave it as she pressed the starter key. That's when it struck her. She was 6 hours away from her family or anyone she knew well enough to help her. Her mother, fortunately, her mother was a very wise woman, had purchased a cell phone with a very basic calling plan for just such emergencies, and it was in her purse. Unfortunately, the car was now in the pits, you know, those places where you go where there's no cell phone service at all. What's a 22-year-old girl gonna do? I think it was about at this point she decided to just make sure her tear ducts were functioning properly. A 40-something-year-old man, office worker, in a pickup truck, pulled over to the shoulder just in front of her, and he got out of the truck and he said, "Hi, honey, got problems?" Although by this time, her nose was slightly blush pink. Her cheeks were more moist than usual. Her speech pattern was a bit more halting. She managed to identify her destination and the trip to that point, her sense of frustration and her helplessness. The man suggested that she get into his truck so he could take her to a nearby garage. It was from the garage she finally was able to call her wise sage of a father for comfort and direction. By the time she called, the car had already been towed into the garage and the problem had been diagnosed. But being late in the day on Friday, the part could not be obtained until sometime later the next week. Jennifer needed transportation long before that. Further, how was she going to get to her interview? Well, as it turned out, she had solved that problem. The 40-something trucker guy offered her his truck to drive into the Stanford for the interview. When she was done, she could bring it to him at his place of employment where he worked in an office. Alarms were going off in her father's head as he listened to this strategy. Can't you imagine? I had just watched Silence of the Lamb. Images too awful to repeat were floating through his head. The urge to scream, "Not on your life, young lady," rose to the surface of his consciousness. But being the sage she wanted him to be, he shifted to, are you certain this is wise? Is this person someone with whom you would be safe? What do you really know about him?" Well, as it turned out, she borrowed the truck, made the interview with only a minor delay, returned the truck, refused a kind offer to go to his house for supper. And waited patiently at the filling station until her brother and his parents made the six-hour trek with a replacement vehicle in tow. Now, there's a whole lot more to the story, but not much more that's relevant to the scripture, so I'll have pity on you and I'll stop it there. Neither Sharon nor I ever met this guy, this generous man, but we were overwhelmed by the generous mercy he showed to Jennifer. He wanted nothing in return for his act of kindness. He saw a need and he responded. Jennifer felt a profound gratitude to that office worker in the truck, and she felt a relief that she received from his predicament was a gift from God. She thought about the goodness of God in this whole process. Her parents also offered prayers of praise and adoration. Jennifer sent the man a letter of appreciation and included with it a small unsolicited check to cover some fuel and a little bit of something toward the use of the truck. Not that he wanted it. That truck driving office worker brokered God's mercy to a stranded girl on the side of a dangerous highway. How do we repay him for the risks that he took? We can't. And I seriously doubt that he thinks of himself as a negotiator of God's mercy, as a broker. But he was. I guess the point of the story is really pretty clear, after all. If we are people who see ourselves as continuing the work of Jesus simply, peacefully, and together, perhaps we might want to be aware of the ways we broker God's mercy. It may be in how we speak to each other, whether we offer kindness or an attitude of superiority. I'll just bet you connect with people a lot, and you offer God's gentle love many times through the week. Students, teachers, farmers, custodians, construction workers, mothers or retirees. I wonder who you've connected with and how you've helped them connect with their heavenly patron this last week. I wonder what you'll do this coming week. Keep your eyes open. I feel confident that you'll see an opportunity up there. And if 1 in 10, if just 1 in 10 recognizes what's happened, that's as good as Jesus got. I hope that today you're able to offer and receive mercy from each other so that you might be re-energized for the work ahead as a negotiator of God's mercy, as God's brokers. There's a world of hurt out there, and there's some hurt even within a couple feet of you right now. People silently crying, "Mercy, have mercy." For some, if they're going to be connected to God, they're depending on us as brokers. We can help them negotiate through the traumas of life by helping them experience the love of God.